Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Graham McQueen. Graham is founding director of the Center for Peace Studies at McMaster University. What better topic to discuss today than peace, with war raging in the Middle East, Obama plans escalating it to what I call in an article, one of three articles I'm working on Syria today. I call one of them, Obama intends shock and awe madness on Syria. I could have called it terror. I called it madness. Either one would have served the purpose, and that's exactly what he has in mind. So-called token strikes. He said he has no token strikes in mind. He has multiple attacks on multiple targets. If enough damage and killing and destruction isn't completed, he'll go back and order more. He's got an armada deployed in the Eastern Mediterranean. Word is he's planning to use B-1, B-2, and B-52 long-range bombers. I wouldn't be surprised if he plans dropping nuclear weapons. Don't expect the media to tell you, the scoundrel media. Well, this is the stuff that's going on in Syria. It's going on day after day. A couple of days ago, AIPAC and 50 other Zionist organizations came out very strongly promoting war on Syria, and they're in full battle mode. They will be descending, AIPAC especially, will be descending on Capitol Hill with, I saw one number, 250 lobbyists. Let's just call it hundreds of lobbyists, just badgering, pressuring, bullying congressmen, representatives, senators, to go for war, despite overwhelming world opposition, overwhelming abroad and in America. Yesterday, across America and across the world, there were anti-Syrian war protests. At best, there were scant reports about this in the major media. I saw an AP report, and I quoted from some of what it said. I'm sure. There's independent media in all of these cities, and I'm sure they reported much more extensively on it. I wish there were more people that got out. I don't know the numbers. I suspect the numbers were fairly modest, maybe scores, maybe a few hundred, maybe more than that. Some cities, of course, will turn out more people than others. New York might turn out bigger numbers. There were protests in my city of Chicago yesterday. There were protests in Los Angeles, my home city of Boston, Indianapolis I saw, other cities across America, cities across the world, mostly in the Western world, Europe, also the Middle East. Extreme anger that Obama is planning another war. And like all of the wars, I would dare say everybody's wars, but especially America's, because America wages so much of them, they're all based on lies, every single one of them. And Obama's planned war on Syria absolutely is planned on big lies, no question about it. There isn't a shred of evidence backing up the accusations that Obama, John Kerry, UN envoy Samantha Powers, others are making against the Syrian government. All lies, all bald-faced lies. None of it is true, claiming Syria uses chemical weapons. No evidence proves it. No evidence comes close to proving it. No evidence ever can prove it, because there is none, except what Washington fabricates. And it's very good at fabricating evidence and fabricating whatever it wants to fabricate, including fake videos, photos, anything it wants to do. It's got experts doing it, the kind of stuff that Hollywood does all the time for movies, except the Obama administration does it for real. He's got lots more killing and destruction in mind. He's already responsible for tens of thousands of innocent Syrians killed. A lot of Syrian soldiers have been killed. But most of the casualties, killed, wounded, millions displaced, Obama is fully responsible, along with the death squads he imported from other countries, dozens of them. They've been ravaging Syria. Death squads. That's exactly what they are. Yesterday, I compared them to the Salvador option in the 1980s, the Central American wars, El Salvador, Nicaragua. That's what these people were. They had a home base in Honduras, and America was wholly responsible for what went on. Went on for years, Finally, America prevailed. I certainly hope it won't turn out that way this time. There's great activism against the war. Great activism. I literally am writing articles on Syria every single day. I would say recently, past couple of weeks, I've written two articles a day, and a number of days I've written three. I'm working on three today. The other two, very briefly, are one titled AIPAC Lobbies for War on Syria. I wrote two other articles on this. AIPAC and 50 other Zionist organizations endorse war on Syria. Again, all based on lies. And a second article I called Stop AIPAC. There's an organization called Stop AIPAC. I quote directly from its policy statement, its agenda, its important things to say, important things to repeat. And AIPAC is now in the fight, descending on Capitol Hill to convince politicians, call them what you will, to go to war against a non-belligerent country, to violate international law doing it, because only the Security Council, no other body in the world, only the Security Council can authorize war, and it never would do it except in self-defense. If it does not authorize it, it's an illegal war, it's an unconstitutional war. According to Article 6, Clause 2, the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution, that states very, very clearly that all conventions and treaties that America signs on to become, quote-unquote, the supreme law of the land. No Congress can pass a law violating international law or constitutional law. Doing so is a crime against peace. A crime against peace. The supreme crime, as the Nuremberg Tribunal called it back in the 1940s, putting the Nazi war criminals on trial. Just Chief Justice Robert Jackson called it the supreme international crime, worse than all the other horrors, torture, mass killing, mass destruction. When you wage lawless wars, all of that results from those wars. And that's why he called it the supreme crime against peace. Obama is guilty of it. Past U.S. presidents have been guilty of it. George Bush, many others as well. It's high time to put a stop to it. It can happen if enough people decide they're not going to take this anymore, and they literally get out there and put enough time into absolutely coming out in force, nonviolent force, nonviolent action, let me put it that way. If enough people do that, as they have before, they can stop this madness. And if they don't do it, well, I shudder to think what the consequences could be. Dare I say, first, regional war in the Middle East, because it won't stop with Syria. Iran is the next target. That is absolutely written in stone. The idea is to destroy Syria, remove it as a regional Israeli rival, isolate Iran, and then target Iran. War plans were drawn to go to war with Iran years ago. They could be implemented any time, and that's the plan. America wants the Islamic Republic destroyed. It wants a Syrian Republic destroyed. It wants unchallenged dominance in the region and worldwide, and it's willing to kill millions of people to do it. And only ordinary people supporting peace have a chance to stop it. I do it every day in what I write in my media reports, on this program, in many interviews I give. I do it every single day, long hours. I can put in more time than other people because I'm retired. I don't have a job to show up to every day. So I'm free to do what I want, and this is my choice, and I intend to do this every single day. I'm able to draw breath, and I'm healthy enough to do it. I hope others will do it as well. I hope they'll spread the word because literally our freedom and justice and survival are on the line. What spreads to regional war very, very possibly could become a global war. And I've named it before. It's no secret. A global war is called World War III. And I've explained on this program before that when nations go to war, if they face a rival anywhere near their equal, they will use every weapon at their disposal, which means nuclear weapons. If Russia and or China gets involved, heaven help us, because that possibly could be a nuclear war. If there's a nuclear war, that's curtains. That's the end. There'll be no more. Graeme, let me let you jump in. I could spend the rest of the program going on like this. I really am absolutely obsessed with this topic, and we want to talk about 9/11 today because you're very, very much involved in that. But your comments on Syria, and then we can jump into 9/11.
Hello, Stephen.
Graeme, it's great to have you on. It really is. I think it was very appropriate to have you on, not just to talk about 9/11 with it coming up next Wednesday, but also the fact that you're so involved in peace studies, and certainly Syria is the eye of the storm today.
Well, Stephen, I'll start by saying two things. First of all, I agree with everything you've just said, and you said it very passionately, so well done. I'm happy to talk about Syria. It's probably the case that you know more about it than I do, though, so I may be reduced to saying, well said, Stephen. I wanted to say a couple more things. First of all, you talk about the anniversary of 9/11 coming up. That's right. Wednesday is the 12th anniversary. It's also, I don't know what the right word for this is, perhaps bizarre is the right word. It may be that this Wednesday will also be the day when the U.S. Senate will be voting on the authorization of force resolution, which has already passed Senate Foreign Relations Committee. I believe that's what it's called. It's being brought to Senate tomorrow. We're being told they may vote on it as early as Wednesday. Now, wouldn't that be interesting if September 11th?
Oh, indeed. And Obama, Graeme,
yeah,
is planning an anniversary eve national address endorsing war on Syria. So a double irony.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, just thinking about the coming together of these two acts of violence and deception is enough to take your breath away. Another thing that came up in my mind when you were talking was the fact that memory is important, and putting things in historical perspective is important. So the fact that you and I are both old guys who are retired, and not only do we have time to put on this, because I spend my time like you do trying to stop wars, but also the fact that we remember stuff because we've been around for a while. I have found lately that many of the people I'm talking to don't even remember Colin Powell's address to the UN Security Council in 2003, because mm-hmm. they're quite young, and that you know, that's almost that's more than 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And how much less then do they remember death squads in El Salvador, for example, in the 80s, which you mentioned? And when you mentioned that, I remembered being in the late 80s in El Salvador and visiting women in the women's prison in San Salvador, students and Christian workers, they were all Salvadorans, who had been abused and tortured, and they told us their stories, and as we went back to our little hotel afterwards, we were quiet in the car, somebody was crying. We drove past the U.S. Embassy, which was this massive concrete fortress in San Salvador, and it was one of those moments for me when you kind of realize how the world's constructed. Those women knew who had done that to them. They knew that the immediate torturers and abusers were Salvadorans, but they knew damn well that it was all being paid for by the United States. They were well-read, they were smart, they had an analysis that goes beyond what most North Americans have. And, you know, they knew what the score was, and they knew what they were in for. And it was simultaneously very sad and, I have to say, very empowering to see, and I've been to war zones at various times in my life, to see what people are willing to risk in order to bring some justice and peace to their societies. And when we see that, the kind of thing you and I do, struggling away, I mean, it's still stuff that's good and that we need to do, but we can't think of ourselves as heroes when we look at what these people are doing. So I want us to take power from people like that who are struggling for justice and peace in those regions, and to be inspired by them to go out and do what we can.
Graeme, they inspire me, and it really is so true. Americans have it easy, Western Europeans. They don't live in a war zone, except for elderly Europeans that have never in their lives lived in a war zone. They have no idea what war is, except what they're taught in school, and of course they're not taught the real truth about all of these things, and who bears responsibility, who are the victims, and who are the perpetrators. You never hear that kind of stuff. And there never should have been a World War One. There never should have been a World War II. There never should have been any of these wars, and they all could have easily been avoided, except warmongers and war makers and war profiteers wanted them, and that's the reason we have all of this struggle. I remember I've read many of George Selder's wonderful books.
Mm-hmm.
He goes back to the 18th. He lived to I think he lived to age 105, if I remember that right. I think he died in 1995, and he was born in the 19th century. And back in the 1930s, before World War II began, between the wars, he talked about, and I forget his language exactly, but really the curse of the war profiteers, that the industrialists that make so much money in wars.
Yeah.
That's all they want. They don't care about who wins or who loses. They win. When the wars, well, they care. They just want to make money.
Yeah.
As long as they make money, that's all they care about. And it was true the way Selders wrote about it in the 1930s. It's the same thing now. I mean, it really is ugly and horrific, Graeme. And nobody cares about the overwhelming human suffering. And even in World War II, as you know, American corporations, like some of the chemical companies, oil companies, IBM, they were complicit with Nazi Germany because they made money doing it. And the Roosevelt administration did nothing to stop them.
That's right. Yeah, no, I agree with all that, Stephen. I agree.
There's a book I have on my shelf, Graeme. I read many years ago, and I forget the author, but the title is Trading with the Enemy. It's
yeah.
about this very, very topic, and it names the companies, big names, that everybody would recognize today. These companies were making money profiteering on war against their own government.
Well, you know, one of the classic books on this, Stephen, which was written, as I recall, gosh, I'm just trying to remember, I think it was just before World War II broke out. I believe in their preface they talk about war clouds gathering. It's clear to them there's going to be another war. And this is the book Merchants of Death. It's one of the classic works, you might say, of peace studies, in which these guys study quite carefully exactly the guys you're talking about, but especially focusing on the arms industry and how these people profit from it, and how they, some of the stories are almost unbelievable, profiting from the death of their own people, profiting from the death of other people, civilians, never mind what, and trading with each other, arms merchants who are supposed to be enemies, and so on and so forth. So they were one of the first sets of people there's two authors to kind of cast a light on this, and the Merchants of Death remain very powerful in all this.
Boy, they sure do. They sure do, Graeme. It really drives the whole process. And I felt deep down that if you could take the profit out of war, you'd have one heck of a chance of ending them. There'd
yeah.
be skirmishes that would break out every now and then, but there'd be nothing major because the profiteers, they love wars that don't end. The Afghanistan War, the Vietnam War went on for over a decade, and the Afghanistan War, longer than Vietnam, longer than World War One and Two put together, astonishing. And
yeah.
the war profiteers love it, and they're comprised of a lot more companies than the Lockheed Martins and Boeings of the world, the technology companies, the consumer goods companies that supply the U.S. forces, and all the companies that provide the government with whatever government needs when it goes to war, and it includes an awful lot of stuff that has nothing to do with bombing or shooting or killing people.
Yeah.
A lot of money to be made.
Yes, you're right.
And they throw stuff away. They're so wasteful that they I don't know how they do this stuff, but they double bill and they triple bill, and stuff gets thrown away, and billions are spent, and nobody knows what it's spent on or what happened to the stuff that's bought. And this goes on and on and on.
Oh,
and again,
yeah.
I mean, this is stuff that's easily known, Graeme, and
I
nobody
know.
Knows anything.
I know. The amount of stuff abandoned in Iraq was amazing. You hear some of the soldiers talking about it, you know, and we just walked away from all these trucks and all this heavy equipment. We just walked away. I mean, we were told to abandon it.
I remember April 1975,
yeah,
when America finally pulled out off the rooftop of the Saigon embassy.
Yeah.
April 9, 1975, there was a lot of stuff on the, I guess, aircraft carriers or whatever other ships. They were dumping helicopters and other stuff overboard.
I know.
It was a lot cheaper back then, Graham, than they are today. They're just dumping the stuff overboard.
I know. Well, for ordinary people like us who are taught to kind of, or at least hopefully, I was certainly taught by my parents to be careful not to waste things. When you look at this, it's just staggering. But of course, waste is part of the game. That's part of the game. It's not just kind of an incidental thing. It's part of how you make money off this stuff. And I'm not a guy who is a heavy law and order guy who wants everybody punished severely and so on and so forth. But when it comes to war profiteers, I think they should be in jail for a very long time. And when there are corporations that also deceive people and thereby trigger wars, such as, you know, you remember the whole incubator baby scandal back in, what was it, 91?
Yep.
1991, that started, that helped facilitate that particular invasion of Iraq. Remind me, what was the PR company?
Oh, I forget the company, but
we'll remember later.
Oh, the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador.
Yeah, I know, that's it. Yeah, I mean, we've got our aging memory here, but the point is, my view is that if any company, any PR company, can be shown to have produced propaganda that led to a war, that company should be ended, terminated. I don't mean that you drop a bomb on it or that you kill people. I'm simply saying the CEOs should go to jail for a long time, as well as everybody who was directly involved in that deception, and the company as a whole should be dispersed. It should no longer exist. And until we start making, punishments that fit the crime, and again, I'm not talking about violence and killing and torturing people. I'm simply saying if corporations are persons, as we're told all the time, then make them accountable the way persons are accountable.
Well, persons, of course, are persons, Graham, and the individuals, the CEOs, the top officials, these are the ones who plan these things,
yeah,
who give orders to others to carry them out. These are the people who should be brought to the criminal courts, whether it's a U.S. court or an international court, the ICC for individuals, the ICC, International Court of Justice for nations.
Yeah.
These people and nations should be held to account in these tribunals, and they should pay the price for the crimes they committed.
Right, I agree. So there we have that. Now, where would you like to go with this?
Well, we have the 9/11, the 12th anniversary coming up,
yep,
and you're involved in Consensus 9/11.
Yes.
Yesterday, Elizabeth Woodworth was on.
Right.
She discussed new information. Maybe if you were involved in that, maybe you'd like to comment on it, or the part of the Consensus 9/11 that you are active in, and anything related to the 9/11 event, and the fact that what Consensus 9/11 does is to come up with hard evidence that debunks the official story.
Right. Well, let me say a word about the 9/11 issue as a whole right now, and then we can talk about the consensus panel by all means, if you like. First of all, I have in front of me the results of the most recent national poll on 9/11, which will be released tomorrow. So I guess this is cutting-edge news here. One in two Americans surveyed have doubts about the government's account of 9/11. Mm. That's pretty interesting.
Oh, that's very interesting.
So according to this particular poll, which is, as I said, is a national poll, 38% of Americans have some doubts about the official account, 10% don't believe the account at all, and 12% are unsure. What that means is that they're, if I'm adding these up correctly, there's only about 40% of Americans who really strongly believe that story now. And what this indicates to me, now, first of all, I'm going to be real careful here. Every poll that's taken asks questions in different ways, with different wording. Very frustrating to me, because it means you can't directly compare them. So you can't actually measure the progress or otherwise that we're making. However, I'm going to make a guess here, and that is that we are making progress based on this poll and how it relates to former ones, and that it means that half of Americans have doubts, and many of them have extremely serious doubts, about the story of 9/11, the official story. Now, this is a big deal. A couple of years ago, I looked at a whole bunch of polls and tried to estimate from different country polls that I looked at how many people in the world were still believers in the official story. And it seemed to me that maybe as many as half the people in the world still believed the official story, but it may have been less than that, because it varies from country to country. Now that I see this poll done on Americans, I'm thinking that the number of people in the world that believe the official story is probably lower than I thought. And it's probably around 40%, between 40 and 45% of the world's adults still accept, you know, uncritically and strongly the official story of 9/11. Now, what does that mean? Well, I mean, that's still a lot of people who are believing something that we've shown for 12 years is absurd. So that's a challenge. But at the same time, it shows that this story is not all that successful. It's in trouble. And I don't think the people that originally came up with the story expected it to be in quite this much trouble. And there are a number of reasons why I think we've been able to help it into a state of collapse. And we need to continue that process. We need to see if we can make the narrative collapse completely. But in the meantime, you know, we have our challenges, we have our agenda, and we work in different ways according to our particular abilities and our social niche to try and awaken people to what that event was about. It was about violence and deception. It was about triggering a whole series of wars, and the one that seems about to begin, the international war in Syria. Obviously, Syria is already in a state of war, but the expansion of that war, still part of the same 9/11 agenda. The attack on Iran, they're all connected. If you see the speeches that George Bush was making in 2001, both before and after 9/11, you can see this was pretty much scripted. And 9/11 had a very important part, so did the anthrax attacks that followed 9/11, in helping this whole thing forward. So it's not like Syria and 9/11 are separate. They're all part of the same thing. I know that you know this. I'm just saying this for the listeners. There was an agenda which the neocons, the Project for a New American Century people, that they laid out. They were pretty clear about what they were going to do. They were pretty clear about the timetable. And they're doing it. I think it's taking them longer than they thought. I think they're running into more obstacles. I think we've managed to gum up the works a few times. And I hope we'll be able to prevent further disasters. But we need to be aware of what we're up against.
Oh, we're up against plenty, Grant.
Yeah.
But it's very encouraging that a majority of Americans no longer believe the official story. I think Americans are the last ones in the world to catch on.
Mm-hmm.
And if those numbers are reasonably accurate, as you reported it, and I'm well aware how polls can not exactly get things right all the time.
Yeah.
But if these numbers are close, I would imagine that the non-believer numbers will continue to grow over time.
Yeah.
And at some point there'll be an overwhelming majority, and maybe there'll even be smoking gun evidence that will come out. That would be the clincher.
It would.
Graham, let's take a quick break.
Okay.
And we'll come back. We'll get right back on the 9/11 story.
Okay.
Welcome back. On with Graham McQueen, talking about Syria, talking about 9/11, and we want to get back and focus on 9/11 because the 12th anniversary is coming up on Wednesday, and you can bet you when anybody who follows the major scoundrel media, you sure won't get the kind of information that we deserve to get, but you always will get it on this program, especially with guests like Graham. Graham, let me let you get back on the story. If you recall your train of thought as we took a break.
Yes, I do. You had mentioned consensus 9/11 panel, and I think that panel is really important, so I do want to talk about it. Any of your listeners who want to visit this can just use their internet search engine and type in 9/11 consensus panel, and they'll find it. So I want to explain why I think the panel is important and why it's doing good work. I would say of the various websites, 9/11 websites that exist, there are a whole bunch of really important ones, but I would give the prize to the Consensus Panel website as the most improved website over the past year. It's very accessible now. It's very understandable by ordinary people. It's more attractive. It draws you in. You can get the point pretty quickly. And so I really, and of course the key thing that distinguishes it from some sites is the care that's gone into choosing pieces of evidence and backing up that evidence. I'd like to take a minute to suggest why I think this is an important initiative.
Graham, can I interrupt you just for a brief moment and let you pick it right back up again?
Yeah.
I wrote an article about Consensus 9/11. It's dated January 31st. Oh, it's old. January 31st, 2012. It's a little bit old, so it's not as up-to-date as it would be today. But I explain what Consensus 9/11 is. And if anybody Googles my name, Consensus 9/11, they can bring up the article very easily. And my subtitle is Seeking Truth, Dispelling Lies.
Good. Excellent. Okay. Well, here's the situation. So you have these massive crimes that happen in the United States, 9/11, and then right after that, anthrax letter attacks. And you would assume, if the state was properly constituted and working properly, that the official investigative bodies would investigate these and find out who did it and so on and so forth. But they haven't. In fact, they're covering it up. And that means that the systems, and it's not just in the United States, unfortunately, have become hugely corrupted. I mean, imagine that you have these tremendous crimes, and they're not going to be investigated. So what does civil society do, meaning the rest of us, the population at large? Well, we obviously have to learn how to investigate things ourselves, and we need to become citizen investigators. We need to create investigatory groups. We need to create institutions because the official ones, the government ones, the state ones, are corrupted. And that's exactly what happened. And the proliferation of groups that people who are, some of them, doing investigation and research for the first time in their lives and doing a lot of brainstorming and good thinking. Many of these are folks who aren't well known. They're more or less anonymous people on the internet, but they're doing tremendous work. And many of the research articles and stuff that I've done have been triggered by reading stuff by, you know, folks whose real names I don't even know. They've got some blogger name. And so this is healthy. This is great. Civil society rose to the challenge. But then, of course, what you end up with is a great mix of stuff. And some of it's really good, it's well supported by evidence. Some of it's not good, it's not well supported by evidence. And there's also disinformation mixed in there from intelligence agencies who are deliberately penetrating the movement. So you need more than a great creative upwelling and a brainstorm. You also then need to get institutions and groups that can help filter this material and sort out the good from the bad. And it would be very bad if there were only one such institution. There are many. There are many different institutions, agencies that are doing this. Every time someone has a conference, in a way, they're doing this. But Consensus 9/11 is one serious attempt to do it. And this group was founded by David Ray Griffin, who's written many excellent books on the subject of 9/11, and Elizabeth Woodworth, retired research librarian whom you had on your show, I guess you said yesterday.
Yes.
These are both people with years of experience. in doing research. They're people who are open to different perspectives, but are also very critical in terms of separating good from bad evidence. So they founded this. They invited a variety of people to form the panel, which currently has approximately 25 members from different parts of the world, and I'm one of them. And then we, the panel, get proposed statements which have to do with points about 9/11, together with the evidence supporting that statement. We do not discuss it with other members. We look at it, we critically read it on our own, and then we relay to the coordinators how good we think this point is, how well is it supported by evidence, and so on. And they do this for several rounds in trying to improve the level of approval among the group. If it doesn't reach an 85% approval rating, it's discarded. It doesn't become one of the consensus points, and that has happened. In other cases, it can be improved, reworded, rephrased, and reformulated until it gets the high level of consensus from the panel, at which point it's put on the website. So when you go to the website and you read the, I think it's currently 37 separate points, consensus points about 9/11, you can be pretty sure that they've been scrutinized, they've been looked at, they're supported by evidence. And this helps then. This is meant to help this social movement, the so-called 9/11 truth movement, as well as the peace movement more generally, by saying, you know, we know that you all don't have a lot of time, like some of us, to do all this research on your own. So here's a site where you can go and you can be pretty confident when you read these points that we're making about 9/11, all the different ways in which the official story is false, right? You can be sure that this has been carefully thought through. It doesn't mean we're right, of course. We could be wrong on some of these, but it means that it's been looked at carefully. So I see the panel as kind of like a council of elders. You know, we are there to look at stuff that's been produced by all sorts of different people and to sift it and to put forward the strongest pieces. And it's a process. It's ongoing. Some things that have been rejected by the panel will, I'm sure, be reformulated and will come back to us and eventually be accepted. So that's the gist of what the panel is and why I think it's so important.
Oh, it is important, Graham. And again, the approach of the panel is so important. But if you can come up with evidence that there really has credibility and just keep mounting it and adding it up, yeah, and coming up with specific pieces of evidence that directly refutes the original story.
Yeah.
And of course, David Ray Griffin has done so much of this in his 10 books on 9/11. Astonishing that he would have addressed 10 books to a single topic and do such an extraordinary job doing it. I hope he has another one in mind.
Well, yeah, he was cranking out, I shouldn't say crank out, it makes it sound like they're all the same book or something. They're not, they're all quite different. But he was publishing about, I guess, 2 books a year for a while there on 9/11, which is quite an output. At the moment, he's finishing a book which I believe is on climate change, another important topic. But he's very much involved still in the 9/11 issue, and as I mentioned, he's not only one of the founders, but one of the ongoing coordinators, which helps this consensus panel work.
Oh, indeed. I mean, we all are so indebted to what David has done. There is nobody who's been more on this story than he has.
Yeah.
And to put out the voluminous amount of credible material on this story that absolutely debunks the official story up one side and out and down the other. I mean, David is one of the great, great heroic figures of our time. There's no question about that. If anybody deserved a Nobel Peace Prize, it's David.
I agree completely.
Elizabeth pointed out yesterday, Graham, that he's been nominated 3 times for the prize, but the people who deserve it most are the ones who never will get it. David, Bradley Manning, Edward Snowden. Instead, they give it to war criminals like Obama and Henry Kissinger, yeah, and others of their ilk.
Yes, I agree. It's Whatever credibility that may have had is long gone.
Oh, it's long gone. He really didn't have any credibility to me before he was elected and took office, because I wrote about him in 2008, Graham.
Yeah.
I went back and I took a look at his Senate voting record.
Yeah.
It was an absolutely horror. It was a horror of voting. He was more Republican than many Republicans. And if anybody, it's all there in the public record. If anyone went back and took a look at it, which very few people do, they would have seen this guy was a phony, a
well,
con man.
I agree with you, Stephen. He was never, I was never attracted to him. I was talking about the Nobel Prize when I said whatever credibility it may have had is gone. As far as Obama is concerned, I agree with you. I don't know why so many progressive people were enthralled to him. I mean, you know, he has a different skin color. He gives a nice, dignified talk with a lot of rhetoric. But come on, guys, we need a little bit more substance than that, and his true nature is being revealed.
Well, absolutely, and I'll go along with Martin Luther King, who said it's not the color of your skin, it's the content of your character.
Yeah.
And Obama never had any that I would want associated with me in any respect. I know somebody who knew him as a student, and I forget whether it was in law school or in college, but he said back then he was a phony.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting. Yeah.
He said other students had caught on to him, and they just didn't trust the stuff that was coming out of his mouth. So even back then, there were people who saw the kind of guy he was. He supposedly was a community activist in Chicago before he got involved in politics, but he was no community activist. It was a cover for a very nefarious agenda. He had other things in mind, and he was singled out back in school, again, I don't know if it was in college or law school, as a comer, and he was vetted, and he was chosen, he was seen to be part of the system, so he was brought up in it, and it got him into Illinois politics, the U.S. Senate, and the Oval Office, and it never would have happened if he wasn't part of the dirty system that you and I, and thankfully millions of other people, oppose, Graham.
Well, I'm afraid to say I agree with you on that. I was just reviewing his speech, which he gave, I guess, August 31st, accusing Syria of using chemical weapons and all the rest of it. I was just reviewing it a few hours ago. And again, it's breathtaking. I always think that I've been around so long that I've become coarsened and I've become used to this and nothing will surprise me anymore. And I'm always wrong, because I'm always surprised at the level of corruption that's going on. I mean, when George W. Bush was pretending to be president, I don't call him president because he was never elected.
He was never elected, exactly.
Yeah, but he was the pretender, what they used to call in European politics and so on, the pretender, somebody who claims, a position of power. So when the pretender was in power, obviously they invaded Iraq without any Security Council authorization. Obviously it was illegal. The Secretary General admitted that. I mean, everyone who's ever looked into it must realize that. But there was a little bit of a charade that went on. First of all, largely because of Powell, I think, who understood the need for a cloak of respectability. I don't think he was substantially different, but he understood the need for a cloak. He kept insisting they try and go back to the Security Council. So, you know, the PNAC people, the hardcore neocons were reluctant, but they finally agreed. Well, they were unsuccessful. I mean, it didn't work. So they had no Security Council authorization. I had to go ahead without it. But even now, if you look into it, you'll see they try to justify it. They have lawyers who will try to pretend that invasion was based on Security Council resolutions, because they realize that at some level they have to pretend to honor international law and the UN. So what I'm saying is breathtaking to me now is that in Obama's speech, he doesn't bother with any of that. He definitely goes a step beyond the pretender. He says, look, I don't care what the Security Council says. I'm not even going to try for a resolution, which is a staggering statement. That's the official public discarding of any pretense at an international order, such as was built up after the Second World War. And he also says, I don't need to go to Congress either. I can do this by myself. I'm going to go to Congress just because, you know, I'm a nice guy and I'm a beneficent leader, but I don't have to. And he also, you know, he doesn't need the UN inspectors, doesn't need them, doesn't need anything. He's basically the decider. He comes close, very close to using the same word as the pretender used. You know, I made the decision. And I find that staggering, and I have to say, as somebody who lives in Canada, we have in Canada one of the worst governments at the moment that we've ever had, period. And our Minister of Foreign Affairs, Mr. Baird, came out the other day and said, well, that's fine, we support them. We agree no Security Council resolution is needed. And in a way, that's even more staggering, you know, because the U.S. and Canada have somewhat different national myths and national stories. And the U.S., it's about freedom, and it's about the U.S. as a nation leading the world and all that. And there's always a lot of suspicion about international organizations like the U.N. In Canada, on the other hand, there was this really central, this really core narrative about how Canada is this good international citizen, and we're all in favor of the UN, we all in favor of international law, we never go it alone, so on and so forth. So for Baird, our foreign minister, to come out and say, we don't really care what the UN says, it's even more of a break than having this said in the United States. It's like discarding one of the primary narratives that has driven this country. And I don't mean that Canada has always lived up to that narrative. Of course not. But nonetheless, that it's there as part of the national myth. And it's kind of a policy coup, really, to use, what's his name's term, General Wesley Clark's term. It's a policy coup in my own country when the foreign minister comes out and says, yeah, the U.S. can go ahead and invade them. They don't need the Security Council approval.
Yes,
and you explained in your preamble today why that's important. I mean, there are only two conditions in the UN as to when you can use military force. One is in self-defense, which obviously this isn't, and the other is when the Security Council calls for it. Well, sorry, neither of them is happening, and therefore it's illegal, therefore it's a crime against peace, therefore it's the supreme crime, as you said, therefore it's a hanging crime, according to Nuremberg. And here's the Canadian foreign minister saying, well, that's okay. So, again, I'm finding myself kind of breathless. I guess I shouldn't be surprised. I should know by now what these guys are made of. But there you go. I am surprised again.
They keep coming up with more and more pretexts, and I've written about false flags being a U.S. tradition,
yeah.
And I repeated what I said in a past article in one of my articles that will go out tomorrow, and American false flags go back to the Mexican War in the middle of the 19th century, Graham. So,
yeah.
So it didn't begin with Remember the Maine,
right.
Let alone 9/11 or the Gulf of Tonkin. It went all the way back, James Polk, to the Mexican War in, 1845. I'd have to go back and double check the date again, but middle of the 19th century.
Right.
So it certainly is nothing new. It's an American tradition indeed.
American is apple pie.
It's apple pie indeed.
Well,
so.
Well, you know, and what we're seeing is that different Western governments are taking. You know, I don't want to make it sound that it's new either. I mean, there's the whole, Western Europe suffered this for decades with Operation Gladio. Again, it's the CIA, it's NATO, in conjunction with criminal groups and the extreme right and various intelligence organizations, carrying out one false flag terrorist act after another in Western Europe, and destroying the left, targeting not just, you know, the Soviet Union, but in all the internal parties, socialist parties, communist parties, popular movements, labor organizations. And so, you know, they've gone through this too. False flags are an old tradition in the West. And I guess I'm hoping that this won't come to be a massive thing in my own country, in Canada. There's not as much of a tradition here. There's lots of fakery, lots of deception. We had these so-called Iranian al-Qaeda types who were identified, what was it, a few months ago or a year ago, who were supposedly wanting to blow up our railway train.
Yes.
I mean, that kind of baloney does happen quite frequently, cooked up by intelligence services here. Normally not violent, normally not a lot of civilian casualties, And I hope that tradition doesn't come here.
Oh, I hope not. It seems to be moving in that direction under Stephen Harper. Uh-huh. I mean, he just in lockstep either with George Bush earlier,
yeah.
with Obama today.
They even used the term lockstep. I don't know if you saw that when they said the other day that we approve of the U.S. actions. And if I'm not mistaken, the term was part of the speech that Baer gave. Or maybe it was Harper, that we are in lockstep. And I thought, you guys don't seem to realize that term doesn't have a very good history.
Again, who cares about international law? The only thing that matters is advancing imperialism, and America does that really outdoes the rest of the world combined in that category. And my own axis of evil, Graham, is a combination of America, Britain, and Israel. Those three countries literally have caused more world misery than any others I can imagine, and in any combination by far, by far. And America's misery goes back to before the nation became a republic in 1776. It's all there in black and white. Anybody can find it if they look for it. Historians like Howard Zinn wrote about it so brilliantly, A People's History of the United States. The history he was never taught in school, the history I was never taught in school, the history kids will never be taught in school, at least during my lifetime.
Yeah, no, you're right, Stephen, and hence the importance of the various alternative and dissident news outlets such as this one.
Oh, and he wrote that book because he was so disgusted that he made comments like all the way up to the doctorate level. He never got the stuff that he really needed to
That's
be taught.
Right.
So he went out. I think his wife encouraged him to do the research and write the book. It turned out to be an extraordinary bestseller, which is so rare for a book like that. Well over a million copies. I don't know how many copies it sold, but it had multiple editions, and on my shelf I've got about three of them.
Yeah, good for you. Yeah, he was a man I admired very much.
I had him on another program I hosted, Graham, once, and very sadly he passed away a couple of years ago now, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
And didn't manage to get him back, but he'd be a wonderful guest to have on now.
Oh, yeah, he would be great. Well, there's a great importance for alternative news sources, and I'm guessing that most of the ones that we're familiar with are presenting a wider spectrum of opinions on the Syrian war than they'll get in the mainstream media. But it's a small minority that are willing to go all the way and look at 9/11.
Graham, indeed, absolutely. And even some of the so-called progressive sites, they'll go so far and no further.
Yeah.
And this program likes to begin where they leave off.
Yes, exactly.
Graham, many, many thanks for coming on. I've got to get you back sooner to continue, whether it's 9/11 or Syria or any other peace-related issue. So vital as America literally, as I like to say, ravages one country after another. We're out of time, but great thanks, Graham.
Thank you, Steve. Join us again
next week.
Okay.
11 o'clock Eastern Time on Fridays, 1 p.m. on weekends. Make it a regular habit.